I'm Jake Brownell, and this is The Big Something, in-depth conversations on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region, a new show from KRCC. On today's show, we bring you interviews about the life and work of three very different figures. First, we speak with Catherine Eastburn, co-founder of the Colorado Springs Independent, critically acclaimed journalist and author, and the writer and voice of KRCC's The Middle Distance.
In my 50s, I got the education that I didn't get when I was younger, and my lifelong dream was to write a book, and I wrote two, and they were published in the same year, but it didn't turn out the way, you know, I thought it would.
Then we'll hear from Jeffrey Keating, a furniture maker and designer whose work has been recognized and sold around the world, and who has chosen to make Colorado Springs his home.
There were a lot of nights where I thought, you know, what did I get myself into? As it's 3 a.m. and I'm like breaking a piece of wood over the shop bench because the piece isn't coming together or whatever.
And finally, we speak with Cory Doctorow, blogger, science fiction writer, and a leading voice on issues of privacy and intellectual property in the internet age.
I think Snowden is a hero, and I think everyone who cares about America should think Snowden is a hero, because it's not good for a country that you love to be riddled with secrecy and corruption, and that's what he's shone a light on.
All that today on The Big Something. Catherine Eastburn has been an indispensable part of the Colorado Springs journalism community since she co-founded the Colorado Springs Independent in 1993. In the time since, she's worked as an editor and freelance writer, written two critically acclaimed books of nonfiction, and penned a weekly column for KRCC, The Middle Distance. This past January, Eastburn wrote and recorded her last installment of The Middle Distance. Longtime friend and producer Noel Black sat down and talked with her about why she decided to retire the column, how she's weathered the upheavals in journalism over the past decade, and what's next.
Catherine, good to have you here in the studio. And of course, what I think everybody wants to know is, why'd you decide to stop doing your column?
I just felt like I was out of town for a good while, for like 6 weeks. And while I was away, it just became clear to me that it was done. Yeah. You know, at that era, is done. I'm entering a new one, and it was about a very particular era in my life, and I didn't want it to get old and boring and repetitive, and it just seemed like it was complete.
It's hard to walk away from things sometimes, but I when you told me, when I got the email from you that you were done, I thought that's a good call, and I'm somebody who likes to begin, have that middle, and then end things, because I think otherwise you get stale, you get bored, even with what could be considered a dream job.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, and I think a lot of people too don't realize the volume. I mean, when I sit down and count it out, it's more than 150,000 words.
Which is pretty big book.
Two books. Yeah. I mean, you know, an average book size is 75,000 words. And so it's a lot.
Yeah.
And you know, it just had reached the point, too, where I was realizing, oh, you know, I've written about that already. And, oh, I've written about that before. And so didn't want to do that.
In some ways, it was a reinvention of the column that you wrote for The Independent for many years. And I wonder if you could just kind of talk about writing a personal weekly column, what that involves. Obviously, you're sharing an enormous amount of your personal life. What do you, you know, you've been doing that for a long time, and I presume you've developed some thoughts about the genre.
Yeah, I love the genre. You know, I teach the genre, and I've been teaching the genre constantly while I was writing The Middle Distance. And so I learned a whole lot by teaching it. But basically, you know, what it amounts to, you know, a personal essay is an exploration. It doesn't necessarily have a conclusion. It means to wander. It means to just wander around inside an idea. And in the case of a personal essay, the idea comes from your personal experience. In the case of Domestic Bliss, most of those experiences came from interactions with my children.
And that was the column you did.
That was the column
title.
I did,
yes.
Before. It was called Domestic Bliss, and it was about learning from your children as you're raising them. And the middle distance initially was going to be about life after child rearing and entering sort of the late stage of middle age when all your kids have gone away and you're trying to figure out, you know, who you are in late middle age. And it happened that, you know, I had a series of intense personal crises in my life at that time. And so it ended up being a lot about that as well.
What was it like living through that publicly? And how did you manage to sustain that through that period of time? I mean, I think for a lot of people, it would have been too much to continue to try to process that in real time.
I think it was really useful personally. I don't know how useful it was to readers, but for me, it was extremely useful because, in fact, it was my son's death that had been preceded by his 25-year-old cousin, my nephew, and the following year, my sister's death, who was 13 months older than me, who died when she was only 55 years old, of early onset Alzheimer's, and then my children's father's sudden and unexpected death. You know, I grieved on paper. You know, I had a place to grieve. I had an outlet. And what I found is that most people don't. There's not a public acceptance of grieving. There's very much a reluctance to look it in the face. There's more a motivation to sort of say to people, okay, that's over now, move on. And that's not how it works, unfortunately. Moving on is, of course, you know, gradually, eventually we do move to a new place, but that doesn't mean that grieving has ended, especially in a situation like the one that my family was in, where we were bombarded with loss and were experiencing a very intense amount of sorrow, and a lot of it was genuine trauma. And I don't use that word lightly. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, we had two suicides in our family, yeah. and that's PTSD stuff.
Right.
And so for me, it was incredibly useful to have this place where I could go and sit and write about this experience and know that I was heard.
I wonder if you could just talk about how the column came together for you each week. And it's funny, we didn't really ever talk about that in the process
as
recording you and editing you for all those years. And I guess I just wonder how it came together. And it always seemed to, you know, have its own logic.
Well, it came about different ways. Sometimes it would be, you know, something that was in the news that just continued to bother me or was, you know, sort of itching and wandering around inside my head, and I just wanted to explore it, you know, on a personal level. Sometimes it came from wanting to understand something that was happening in my life or in my family's life or in my town's life. But the process was I would get an idea and then just live with it, drive with it, sleep with it, make notes, think about it, and then kind of sit down and have a big multiple-hour writing session. But that tends to be more my method than anything else, is to get the idea in my mind and then develop it, thinking about it, just wandering around, you know, in the car, on my feet, walking the dog, whatever, and living with it for a while.
Would the piece veer away from the idea or sort of develop in the process of the writing?
No, it was pretty well developed by the time I sat down to write it. I pretty much, by the time I sat down to write it, I had a very clear idea where I wanted it to go. And that became more a process of just writing it and then going back and crafting sentences after I got it down.
And when you teach nonfiction, is that an approach that you teach, or do you feel like that's just one way of going about it?
That's just one way of going about it. There are millions of ways of going about it, and I think every writer has their own way, for sure.
Your career really began late in life. You really got going after you got divorced, and you helped start The Independent. And then you ended up going to graduate school after you left The Independent and subsequently wrote two books. You wrote Simon Says, and you wrote a book about shape notes, singing, and those were also close together. And I wonder if you could reflect a little bit about being somewhat of a late bloomer and also pursuing a career later in life that is one that is fraught with peril for anyone, no matter when they start that in life.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you know, I was a stay-at-home mom for many, many years. I had a lot of kids. My kids spanned, you know, a long period of time. I kind of now, I look at it as, you know, I did this one thing, starting The Independent, learning to be a journalist, writing tons of stories in my 40s. In my 50s, I got the education that I didn't get when I was younger. And my lifelong dream was to write a book. And I wrote two in the same period of time, and they were published in the same year. But it didn't turn out the way, you know, I thought it would, because my son died the year that my books were published. And so, you know, all of a sudden that thing of having these books out there to go and promote was definitely secondary to what else was going on in my life. And, you know, now I'm in my 60s and I want to do something else altogether. And I'm not even sure what. It'll definitely involve writing. There's no question about it. I will never be able to write all the things I want to write in my lifetime, but I don't think any writer does. I mean, I guess Philip Roth did. Didn't Philip Roth say at 80, I retired, yeah. I'm not doing it anymore?
We don't have to talk about Philip Roth.
Yeah.
Do you have any regrets that you weren't able to promote those books as much as you would have liked to, and that you couldn't just feel the glory and the high of having accomplished that so quickly also yeah. after you got out of grad school?
Sure. Yeah. It was a terrible thing. It was a real loss. You know, I would go and I'd talk on the radio with people about them, or I'd go and, you know, have a book signing or, you know, whatever, or go to a Sacred Harp singing and have all this enthusiasm around me about the book. And I couldn't absorb it at that point in my life. I couldn't feel it. I couldn't. I was so overwhelmed with everything else that was going on that I wasn't able to enjoy it. I really wasn't. But, you know, I stand by them. I'm still proud of them. I'm happy they're out there. I'm happy that I made them. I love the process of making both of them, but I didn't get any pleasure out of that.
Especially Simon Says seems like it could have been the kind of book that had you had the time and the energy to promote it. It's an incredibly compelling story, incredibly disturbing story. What are your thoughts about that book these years later?
Well, I've gone back and read it recently for the first time, and I thought it was a good read.
Just for people who haven't read it, can you give a little quick summary of the story?
Yeah, it was a local story about a group of boys who went to Palmer High School, who made a series of very bad decisions and ended up being prosecuted for the murders of three people, some grandparents and their 15-year-old grandson. It was very complicated. I had covered the court proceedings for The Independent for a number of years and was fascinated with this story because these boys were the same age as my sons. They were local. They lived in our neighborhood. They went to the same high school. And it was just a big, big tragedy, just a huge tragedy all around. But I wanted to ask the question, how can something like this happen in your neighborhood, in our town, in our local high school? You know, how does something like this come about? It was a very dark experience doing the research, reading the documents, doing the interviews. It was very, very scary and very dark. But, you know, I think it's a good read. I think it's a decent book. And I don't know. I don't know if it helped anyone. You know, I don't know if it really served any purpose out there, but it certainly was a riveting story. And it was right. It was after Columbine, a few years after Columbine, when these crimes occurred. And so, you know, the timeliness was there as well.
Have you followed up on the story at all? Have you heard news of Simon Sue? What's happened in the intervening time?
Well, you know, everybody's pretty much in prison for a very long time. And I've heard, you know, some stories about how different people have, you know, made their lives while in prison. I can't really confirm any of them, so I'd rather not share them. Mm-hmm. But it's a sad thing. I mean, I got to know their families. I got to know their parents. And they lost their children, too. That's how I see it. You know, that's pretty much the end result.
You left the Independent and began your writing career at a time when it still seemed possible to make a living as a writer, especially if you had a decent-selling nonfiction book on the market and you got two book deals kind of at the same time, and you could still freelance for a magazine for a buck a word. And then the whole industry just sort of imploded. And I wonder how you've reacted to that and what your thoughts are on making it through the rest of your career as a writer.
Well, I feel like I'm in the middle of the whirlwind that everyone is in the middle of now. And I don't feel that I have any amount of insiderly, cachet in publishing at all. I certainly don't. In fact, my agent quit agenting, which is a very common problem in publishing. A whole lot of agents quit their jobs and went and became teachers or college professors or whatever, because they saw the direction the industry was heading. The big issue now that my students bring to me is, do I self-publish or do I try to get a contract with a book publisher? And it becomes more and more difficult to reach an agent, to reach a publishing house, to actually get representation in the business. And so I'm trying to learn everything I can about self-publishing like everybody else. I'm in the very same position that pretty much everybody out there is, unless you are Jon Krakauer or, some very, very well-known famous writer already. Granted, there are lots of memoirs coming out talking about the nonfiction world, but if you look at the memoirs that come out, most of the people who get contracts for a memoir are people who had a big novel or were well known as poets or were well known in some other genre. So, we're all just in the midst of throes of change right now. And I'm in the middle of it, too.
So what are you working on right now, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, I've been working for about 5 years on a novel that is going absolutely nowhere.
It's easy for those to go nowhere.
Yeah. So, I really hesitate to throw it away or I just stuck it in the drawer for now. I want to make something of the middle distance. I don't know what, some sort of collection or maybe it's the notes for my memoir. I'm not sure. Right now, I'm going through years and years worth of notes and files that I've been keeping about this experience of extreme and sudden traumatic loss and seeing what comes of that.
Any sense of a more regular column type thing or stepping back into journalism at all? Do you think that'll happen?
No, I don't think so. Every now and then, I get wind of something that seems to me like it would make a wonderful story, and I think I'd love to pitch it to someone and work on it. But I don't know. I would need financial support to do that for one thing, and I don't really see that happening much.
Well, we hope you will drop by here or do a story with us every once in a while.
I would love to do that. I wish I knew how to do all this radio stuff.
We can push the flashing buttons. You can help us with the story.
Okay.
All right. Catherine Eastburn, thank you so much. And thank you for all the years of the middle distance.
Thank you, Noel. And thanks to everyone who read it and listened to it for 4.5 years. I really appreciate you guys.
That was producer Noel Black speaking with author and journalist Catherine Eastburn. You can listen to this interview again and listen to old episodes of The Middle Distance at krcc.org. This is The Big Something. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Big Something, a new show from KRCC featuring in-depth conversation on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. I'm Jake Brownell. After a century defined by mechanization, standardization, and globalization in virtually every sector of the American economy, the backlash is now in full effect. Around the country, there's a growing movement to forgo cheap, mass-produced goods made halfway around the world in favor of things made locally, by hand, using techniques that date back to well before the industrial era. Our next guest, Jeffrey Keating, in many ways embodies this cultural shift. Once an aspiring academic working toward a PhD in religious studies, Keating chose to leave the academy behind, opting instead to pursue a passion for traditional woodworking. Since starting his furniture business, Keating Woodworks, in 2008, he's been on the cover of American Craft magazine, been featured on some of the most popular design blogs on the internet, and managed to build a thriving business selling his handcrafted, one-of-a-kind pieces to customers around the world. All this, he's managed to do out of his studio in the Old North End neighborhood of Colorado Springs. I recently spoke with Keating about his life and career, first at his shop, and then again in studio at KRCC. You'll hear excerpts from both conversations in the following interview.
So that's the piece spinning. And then when you introduce the tool into the work using the tool rest as a kind of a steady, then it'll have a little bit of a different sound.
I'm Jeffrey Keating, a furniture maker and designer, and we're at my shop, Keating Woodworks, in Colorado Springs. The building that we're in was built in 1897, and it was originally a grocer, Whitehead Market. And all the way up through the 1980s, it was some sort of grocery store or convenience store. And then it was a pottery studio for a little while and then kind of a home boutique store. And then we got it about 2.5 years ago and have been kind of renovating it and adapting it to suit our needs.
And you live upstairs too?
Yep, we got a wife and we got two little ones and yeah, we live upstairs.
Jeffrey, you personally came late to woodworking in your life, but you come from a long line of five generations of woodworkers, is that right? And what kind of work were they doing?
Most recently, they were doing churches in the Southwest, so kind of New Mexico, Texas, Arkansas area. And they would just build these small country churches. That was kind of their specialty, and they would travel around, build a church at a time. And it was one of those deals where they would build not only the church, but everything inside it. So they would, you know, if there was a Catholic church, they'd do the pews and the altar and what have you. And then most recently, though, actually my uncle, he did more things like kitchen cabinets and things like that. So
growing up, you were aware of this heritage in your family, this legacy of craftsmanship.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it was something that just kind of hung with me. I actually went off to college and it was just something that I'd always wished that I had done. But I think when I was young, you know, you're not... I don't know. There's these opportunities maybe that pass by you and you're young and you're just, you know, I got other things I want to do. And then being in college and then going on to grad school and thinking like, I really have this desire to do something with my hands. And woodworking was just a natural connection for me, thinking back through what people on my mom's side of the family had done and something that I'd always wanted to do a little bit more of.
Going back, you grew up in Texas, is that right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and whereabouts in Texas?
Amarillo, Texas, in the Panhandle.
And so you leave that behind and you go off to college and what then?
Well, yeah, so I was actually a religious studies major and then went to a small school in San Antonio called St. Mary's. And then from there went to grad school at a couple of different places, went to Notre Dame and Yale. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the books. I enjoyed kind of interacting with the students. As a grad student, I taught some undergraduate classes. And... there was just this aspect to it, though, that I felt like, I don't know, it was just kind of, it wasn't soul-sucking. I don't want to make it sound like it was this corporate job where I'm just moving numbers around on a page or something like that, but definitely something was missing. So, yeah, I actually ended up kind of picking up woodwork, and I started buying a few hand tools and a few small power tools on the side just to give myself something to do to help keep my sanity.
What was your area of focus when you were in grad school?
Religious studies major in undergrad and grad school, and ethics was my concentration. So yeah, a lot of philosophy and kind of like Western Christian figures.
There's actually kind of a history in philosophy of these philosophers who spend their free time maybe thinking about these big metaphysical questions or what have you, but in their day jobs, they're focusing on something very tangible, kind of manual labor. But for you, it was sort of the inverse of that.
Right, exactly. No, it was interesting. There was a philosopher at Notre Dame when I was there, kind of a prominent guy named Alistair MacIntyre, and he did a lot of work in virtue theory. And his idea was you had to focus on these kind of concrete everyday acts that we perform in life on a regular basis, inculcate and cultivate the proper virtues. And then that kind of then laid the basis for maybe like a Socratic reflective life of some sort. But this idea of the virtues that you would kind of put yourself in the service of these different practices. He would always use these Norwegian fishing villages as an example that he would give of learning this craft and this trade and these kind of these practical, you know, mundane pedestrian virtues in a way, but something that had to be taught and passed on. And that really fascinated me as a student. And then really coming to that as a woodworker and looking back at just the history of woodworking and the way in which there's just, it's a craft and there's these skills that are passed on that you have to kind of master before you can take a piece of wood and kind of turn it into an idea, you know?
So you sort of gravitated toward that idea of tradition and of this handing down of techniques and
right.
skills and that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah, I would have loved to have kind of like placed myself at the foot of a master, so to speak, and learned the trade from someone, but it's just, it's such a dying craft. There's definitely people doing it and doing it at an extremely high level, but it's not ubiquitous in the way it once was. So a lot of it for me was thinking, okay, I can't do it at the foot of someone, you know, in person. The best I could come up with, you know, were books, the internet, YouTube videos, Google.
So you sort of took a scholarly approach to something that isn't necessarily thought of as a very scholarly act.
Right. Yeah, no, I always kind of thought my background in the academy served me well to get me set up to figure out, okay, how do I research this? I need to figure out how to do this type of joint or what have you.
Am I correct in noticing that you don't use a lot of screws or nails? You kind of join things together?
Yeah, everything's kind of joined in the traditional way. So whether it's like a dovetail joint or a mortise and tenon joint, and then using the joint along with glue to provide the structural strength for the piece. But yeah, that's just kind of the traditional way that furniture makers have been doing it. So yeah, I guess, you know, I think in... like archaeological digs in ancient Egypt, they'll find examples of different types of like hide glue that they were using. Wow. So yeah, it's just been kind of joinery and glue has been this kind of the standard way of making things for thousands of years now.
What did you start to get your feet wet doing with woodworking?
Yeah, so I went out, like I said, and kind of started collecting some hand tools and a few small power tools. And with the hand tools, I would just do, some of the books that I would get would have little small projects. And so, you'd work on this little joint, and then you'd glue the boards together. And that would be it. It wouldn't actually be, you know, anything concrete. It wouldn't be a box or a jewelry box or anything like that. And that's where I started out with kind of the traditional methods of woodworking. But on a little bit more of a practical scale, I just started building some, you know, small things for friends, like bathroom vanities. And a lot of it would just be kind of plywood or scrap wood or whatever I could kind of find on the cheap. When we were all grad students, no one had any money or anything, so it was usually I got paid in beer, you know. So it was just kind of cobbling these things together and figuring out how it'd go together and be structurally sound. So it's kind of a mix of working on some hand tool techniques and then just small projects for friends.
While you were doing this as a hobby, at what point did you start to really feel like, this is what I would rather be doing? I don't necessarily want to spend my time teaching or reading or in the academy.
Right. Yeah, right away. I didn't think it was practical. But as soon as I really picked up my first tool, I mean, it sounds kind of like a cliche, but you know, you love it first sight or what have you. But yeah, picking up a handsaw and cutting wood with it and then seeing, you know, a few pieces of scrap or plywood come together and form something concrete in front of me, those tangible that I get my hands on. It was so appealing to me, and I thought, oh, this would be amazing if I could figure out a way to do this every day. But I think it took me a while to kind of make that jump of like, oh, that might be a reality.
I think that's something that a lot of people can probably relate to, people who have different kinds of craft hobbies, or maybe they have things that they sell on Etsy or what have you, but they can't necessarily imagine actually doing it full time and taking that leap. What was it that switched for you when you just finally felt like, all right, this is feasible and this is something I want to do?
It was a pretty organic process. A lot of the initial early work came to me. So once I got better with my hand tools and started to feel a little bit more confident in my woodworking skills, on the craft side of it, a couple professors asked me to build desks for them. And so I built a couple desks, and, you know, that kind of led to a couple other things. And then at one point I ended up doing a couple kitchens. So, and I was still a grad student this whole time, so I was kind of doing all these projects nights and weekends, wherever I could cram it in. And as that started to grow and I started to think about it being viable as something that might pay the bills, I think the idea of it became a little bit more of a reality. There was a concreteness to it rather than just, oh, this is a really nice hobby and I enjoy it and it helps keep my sanity while I'm in grad school. It became something that I thought, oh, this could really work. Yeah, and then I got married. So I think that was a little bit more of, there was kind of some hesitancy there. You know, maybe if I were single, I was like, ah, let's just make a go of it. But I got married, and then actually my wife, Anna, she was very supportive of it, and she kind of encouraged me to say, you know what, if you want to do it, if you feel like the academy isn't going to be your place, if you're not going to be happy there, and this other thing seems to be going, you know, go for it.
Mm-hmm. Did you immediately feel like that was the right decision, or did it take a little bit of time to feel like you got your feet under you?
Yeah, it took some time. You know, it's, you know, when I decided to do it and say I'm going to do this full time, I just dove in. But there were a lot of nights where I thought, you know, what did I get myself into? As it's 3 a.m. and I'm like breaking a piece of wood over the shop bench because the piece isn't coming together or whatever. And it's like, you know, how am I going to pay the bill? So right after, right about the time we decided, okay, we're going to do this full time, my wife got pregnant. And so we got this little boy on the way, and I'm thinking like, oh man, I got this. We're having a family, and I'm trying to do this woodworking thing, and I don't know if it's going to work out. A lot of people were very doubtful of what I was doing. They thought, oh, you spent all this time in grad school, and now you're just going to quit and then try and become a furniture maker, and this is, you know, that's something you just started. And so there was a lot of anxiety, there was a lot of stress, but yeah, I just kind of kept trying to put one foot in front of the other day after day, get up early, work late. So it took a long time, I think, before I started to feel like, okay, I'm comfortable where I'm at. This thing is going to work. Everything's going to work out.
And so fast forward to the summer of 2013, and you're on the cover of American Craft magazine, which is a huge honor. How did that come about? Were you surprised that all of a sudden there was this interest in your work, or had that just been kind of gradually building over time?
Yeah, it had been building a little bit. But, you know, I've gotten a lot of emails from people who are trying to do something similar and, you know, asking for advice and like, oh, you know, I feel like you've kind of had this nice trajectory from a career perspective. And do you have any insights to offer, any advice? And, you know, I wish that I had more to offer. A lot of it for me, it just kind of worked out. You know, I worked hard, but there were a lot of lucky breaks, a lot of people that were helping me out. And it, you know, in terms of publicity, something like American Craft, you know, they just called me up one day, you know, so I don't know. I don't even know how they found me. You know, my first kind of big break from a publicity perspective was there's a big design blog called Design Sponge. And a friend of mine knew someone who worked there and just sent an email with a picture of one of my pieces, said, hey, this is a guy I know, saw some of his work in person a while back, you guys might be interested. And they ran my stuff, and just kind of from there, you know, things took off from that side of things. It wasn't really anything that I did, or I wasn't out there pounding the pavement and hustling it, you know, it just kind of happened.
And so how would you characterize your design sensibility in terms of modern antique was a way that I saw it described at one point.
Right, yeah. So I think I love to take, and some of that maybe is just kind of my sensibilities of, you know, the timelessness of traditional woodworking, and to take some of these older lines, like a Windsor chair, for instance, and then adapt it to a little bit more of a contemporary aesthetic, something that I find a little bit more appealing, but still something that rings true to the original form. So yeah, it is kind of maybe like a contemporary antique or neo-traditional or something like that, where I kind of play off of these old traditional shapes, clean up the lines a little bit and try and make it my own.
That's not an easy thing to do, to take a form that is so familiar and that has this tradition of being made in a particular way for so long, and to adapt it in a way that's unique but also true to that tradition.
Yeah, and it's interesting that kind of the interplay with thinking through what I do as like a mix of things. So it's a little bit, there's craft to it. There's kind of, there's design to it. There's kind of this artisanship to it and how those interplay. And so a lot of, when I first started, I don't think my skill set as a woodworker was strong enough to build a lot of the things that I had in my head. And so as that kind of started to catch up with some of my ideas, and then the ideas and my skill set were able to kind of play off of each other, I felt a little more comfortable with some of the things that I was building. But yeah, from a design perspective, it's tough. A lot of things, after I'm finished with them, I want to throw it away. You know, you're like, that looks like garbage. I hate that. So yeah, it is tough. And sometimes it's nice to have a piece that's been commissioned and say, I've got to build it and be done with it and ship it off to a client. There's a finality there. I don't have to look at it anymore. But that is, I think that's the most challenging thing of what I do for me, is to just try and think through the shapes and the designs and try and work out something that I think is true to me, something I like, something I would want in my house.
So up there, are those, it looks like stools?
Yeah, so a lot of the pieces I've got, there's a lot of stuff in my studio that's in process. And some of it are pieces that are commissioned, that are kind of in process, that are working its way towards a client. And then some are things like, I've got some seat blanks here and the workings of kind of a three-legged stool that are kind of more in the design phase that there's not a buyer for yet, and it's just something I'm messing around with. So that's a lot of what these guys here are just kind of prototypes, things that I'm hoping to turn into an actual piece at some point. And I'll kind of spend some time and work through it. Toss the stuff I don't like, kind of build on the stuff I do like.
When did you move to Colorado Springs?
We moved here in 2012.
Colorado Springs isn't necessarily a capital of the kind of thing that you're doing. You know, when you think of the craft movement, I think of places like Asheville or... that's the first one that jumps to mind, or maybe Brooklyn or whatever. What's it been like for you to do what you do and to do it on a national level where you're getting this kind of exposure that you've gotten, but to do it out of a place like Colorado Springs?
Yeah, it was something I thought of when I first started, not in terms of Colorado Springs, but I was in South Bend, Indiana when we first started our business. And while there's, you know, kind of quite a bit of difference between the two places, there was still that sense of like, oh man, I'm out in the middle of nowhere in terms of any recognition of design or anything along those lines. And I thought, like, how is anyone even going to find out about me, much less, you know, commission something that has to be shipped across the country? So that was something I had to think through and tackle a little bit when I was there. And I faced some similar things in Colorado Springs, but I find it hugely beneficial. I've got several friends who build furniture who are in Brooklyn, and it's just nuts there. You know, I've got one guy who's a friend, and he's got a shop space that's a little bit smaller than mine, and he pays $4,000 a month just for for rent on his studio. And then he's got to worry about getting materials in and transporting things and getting around the city and what have you. And there's an appreciation for that there, which is nice, and I think that helps him, you know, in terms of, like, kind of media recognition and, like, a built-in clientele. I ship probably 80% of the things that I make get shipped to either Manhattan or Brooklyn.
Wow.
But it's so freeing for me to come here and have a nice, well-lit studio at a fraction of the cost, to walk out my back door and the Front Range is just right there staring down at me, you know, and still have kind of a vibrant arts community here. So for me, I find it rewarding. I find it fulfilling, you know, something that kind of like helps fuel me a little bit, being here, being out of the kind of the epicenter in some ways, and not always looking at other people's designs. I think that becomes a problem where you see a lot of stuff looks really similar to what everyone else is doing. So to kind of be away from that a little bit and insulate yourself from that and think through some of your own ideas a little bit apart from what's going on, that's been really helpful.
Jeffrey, thank you so much for coming into the studio and talking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm Jake Brownell, and that was my conversation with Jeffrey Keating, furniture builder and designer, whose business, Keating Woodworks, has been based in the Old North End of Colorado Springs since 2012. To hear that interview again, and for links to pictures of Keating's work, head to krcc.org. This is The Big Something. We'll be right back. Jake Brownell, and this is The Big Something, a new show from KRCC featuring in-depth conversation on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. Activist, author, co-editor of the influential blog Boing Boing, and contributor to The Guardian, The New York Times, and countless other publications, Cory Doctorow is one of the most influential voices of the 21st century. He's also the author of numerous books of fiction and nonfiction, including Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, a book about earning a living as an artist in the internet age, as well as the young adult novels Little Brother and its sequel Homeland, both of which explore the topics of civil liberties and social activism in the age of the internet. Producer Noel Black spoke with Doctorow by phone in advance of Doctorow's talk at Colorado College last week.
First thing I wanted to ask you was about seeing your book Homeland appear in Laura Poitras's Citizen 4. I wonder what your reaction was and then what your thoughts were after that, because my reaction would have been probably just abject paranoia.
Oh, no, I didn't feel any paranoia. I knew it was going to be in the movie. I'd gotten advance word. And Laura actually brought it to Hong Kong for Ed, who I think was very fond of it. But he didn't go on the lam with my book to read, as romantic as that would be to think. No, I was immensely proud and delighted. I think Snowden is a hero, and I think everyone who cares about America should think Snowden is a hero, because it's not good for a country that you love to be riddled with secrecy and corruption, and that's what he shone a light on.
The plot of Homeland and of Little Brother is can you call it prophetic, given that it happened almost simultaneously? But it's almost as if you saw this coming as an inevitability.
Well, I think science fiction writers who try to predict the future are like drug dealers who sample their own product. It never ever ends very well. And I have never made a pretense to being predictive. Or if I'm predictive, I'm predictive of the present. Because after all, in 2005, a very brave man named Mark Klein, who had worked for AT&T and had built a secret snooping room at the NSA at AT&T's main switching center in San Francisco, came into the Electronic Frontier Foundation with a bunch of documents that he brought out and blew the whistle on mass surveillance. And, he was on the front page of every newspaper, and EFF has been suing the U.S. government ever since. But it was a news item that rose and then sort of sank, partly because it turned on all these very technical questions about the law and secrecy. And as a consequence, the case sort of dragged on and on and on through multiple presidential administrations. And so, Snowden wasn't the first, he was the latest, and I think not the last. Actually, that's one of the things we learn in the Poitras movie, is that there's another NSA whistleblower who's still inside the NSA, as far as I know, and smuggling out more evidence of wrongdoing. And so what a science fiction writer can do is, by paying attention to the things that are going on around us that just haven't caught the public eye and writing about them as though they had, a writer can appear to be prophetic. But, if I'm predicting anything, I'm predicting 2005.
Sure. And then there was obviously the WikiLeaks and Chelsea Manning and then Edward Snowden. Do you think that the public has, maybe an unlimited ability to forget?
Oh, I think that it's very hard to keep track of it all. And it's also, there's a kind of cognitive dissonance that comes into play when you hear about something very terrible that you can't do anything about. It's really hard to keep that front and center in your mind. Your mind really wants to go back to normal and say, yeah, that terrible thing is going on, but, your kid still needs braces and you still need to go to work and there's still that weird mole that you need to see the doctor about. And it just dries it out. I mean, to a certain extent, you think it'd be kind of pro-survival to just not pay a lot of attention to things that you can't do anything about. But what I think has happened with each of these leakers is that they have been, on the one hand, more and more media savvy. I mean, if you think about the Assange strategy versus the Snowden strategy, Snowden learned a lot from Assange. He's talked about that and about how he's learned a lot about how to relate to media organizations from Assange. And as a result, he was able to make his story stick more. But also the number of people who cared about this stuff grew with every one of these acts. And so the sense that there's other people out there who will work on this with you, that it's not just your own problem, has grown as well. And so 3 months after Snowden came in from the cold, the Pew Internet Research Project announced that 87% of the Americans they'd surveyed had done something affirmative to protect their privacy. And that, I think, will be something of a tipping point. Because the interesting thing to note about those 87% of Americans is that nothing that they did had actually done anything to protect their privacy, because your browser and the services that you use don't really have a tick box that makes a meaningful difference in your privacy. Mm-hmm. I mean, Facebook, all of those tick boxes on the Facebook privacy dash really exist for the same reason the lines on the crap table are there, so you can't calculate the odds, you know, just to confuse you. But, you know, Silicon Valley doesn't spy on people because it is ideologically committed to spying. It spies on people because it has no ethics and it's ideologically committed to money. And if 87% of Americans want a product that no one's selling, that's an opportunity. And I think we've seen tons of investment activity and also nonprofit activity in providing privacy technologies to individuals.
And at the same time, Facebook is insisting that people use their real names and getting ready to kick people off. Is this going to be an ongoing tension between Silicon Valley and the public interest?
Well, to a certain extent. I mean, a lot of the services that we use, we generate data on, not because the services are designed to create a kind of smog of data in our exhaust, but because it's just hard not to create data. It is the smog of the 21st century. But Facebook in particular, and more generally the surveillance business model, seem to be coming to a turning point. If you pay attention to Facebook's investor filings, you'll see that they're really just not making a whole ton of money off of spying on us. You know, you add up the number of users Facebook has and then divide it by their market cap, and you find that all of the secrets of your life, every compromising fact about you, is worth less than a dollar to Wall Street. And when you look at where their major revenue sources are and where their growth is coming from, it's not coming from targeted ads, because so far big data just hasn't paid those big dividends. You know, it's one thing to say, oh, someone taking folic acid is probably pregnant. That's a thing direct marketers have known for 30 years. But it's another thing to try to predict without seeing anything else about you that you're about to buy a car. And that's why the advertising rates for car ads on Facebook and other ads for things that are high-ticket items that you don't buy very often, that's why their prices are so low, is because those ads just aren't all that effective. Meanwhile, Facebook has this other program, which is that they look for businesses that are signing up tons of followers, right? The cafes that are saying, you know, you have free coffee if you follow us on Facebook. And they make sure that those companies, whenever they send out an announcement, that it goes to all of their followers so that Facebook becomes more and more integral to their business. And then once they reach a certain critical threshold of followers, they turn it off, and they only send out their updates to 6% of their followers. And their salespeople call up the businesses and say, from now on, it's $5 for every 1,000 people you want to reach now that we're integrated into your business. It's not the surveillance business model. It's the drug dealer business model, where the first taste is free. And, you know, that's creepy too, but it's creepy in a different way. I think that, you know, we haven't reached peak surveillance, but we've certainly reached peak indifference to surveillance. There's never going to be a future in which fewer people care about the fact that we're being spied on.
But do you think that that indifference translates into this sort of panoptical effect where people are censoring themselves effectively?
I think that there are elements of that for sure. I certainly do. And I've heard from people about things like not searching for certain search terms because they're anxious to I guess you could call it the Cardinal Richelieu problem. Cardinal Richelieu was one of the architects of the French Revolution. He very famously said, if you give me 6 lines in the hands of an honest man, I can find in them a reason to hang him. And so they're worried that their actions might be misinterpreted. And I think that on the one hand, that chilling effect is not good, because there's lots of things that people do and say that they may not want to have out in public, but that are legitimate and even vital. I mean, we just had this movie celebrating the life of Alan Turing, who was hounded to death for doing something that today is legal, but back then was something that he had to keep out of the public eye. And it seems unlikely that we live in a society that's finally gotten it right, and that 50 years from now, there won't be people going, oh my gosh, I can't believe that in the early 21st century, being out in public about something that we hate was grounds for being drummed out of society as we know it. And so we want to protect those people, and it's sad that those people are self-censoring. At the same time, it's also an opportunity for firms and for activists and for activist organizations to get people using more privacy-oriented security tools. And privacy is a team sport. You know, I keep all my mail on my own laptop, and it only goes through my own servers, which I maintain. But everybody I correspond with uses Gmail. And so all of my email is also on Google servers. And that means that if there's if there's a Prism warrant or if there's some other form of mass surveillance that's inside of Google's data centers, that all of my data can be slurped up too.
Wanted to ask you about surveillance in the United Kingdom where you live. You know, just from watching British spy shows or spy movies, it seems that the UK is way further along in their video surveillance, their CCTV technology. What's your feeling about surveillance in the UK compared to the United States?
Well, again, it really seems to be like the surveillance stuff is not paying the dividends that they expected it to. I mean, when they started putting cameras everywhere, they didn't really think about who would get to look at that footage and who would make sure the cameras were working and what it meant to divert resources that you could use to, for example, put a cop on a beat and instead pay for a whole ton of cameras that would be indifferently maintained and networked and that may or may not let you catch criminals in the act. The research on CCTVs is that if you put them in places where people commit crimes that involve planning, like parking garages, where people go, you know, I'm going to stand in the shadows in this garage and rob people, and I'm going to think about it in advance, that it has some effect on that kind of crime. But a lot of the crime that the British public worry about, the kind of quality of life lifestyle crimes, are things like drunk people getting into fights. And drunk people getting into fights are, by definition, people who aren't thinking about consequences. So cameras don't stop them from doing bad things. It just makes it easier to punish them. And we didn't really have a giant punishment gap in the whole realm of drunk people getting into fights. By the same token, you know, when they filled up Vancouver's gas town with CCTVs, which is the heroin capital of North America, in the run-up to the Olympics, you know, by definition, junkies are not people who make good decisions about their futures. And unsurprisingly, filling that region with CCTVs didn't do much to stop petty street crime. The biggest risk right now in the UK is that surveillance plays with a certain fearful proportion of the population, that promising to spy on people makes a certain number of voters very happy. And in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attacks, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, who's running for re-election this year, David Cameron, swore that if he took office, that he would ensure that there was no good cryptography left in the United Kingdom, that you wouldn't be able to scramble a message so that the police couldn't read it. And of course, if you scramble a message so weakly that the police can read it, then so can the mafia and foreign spies and voyeurs and identity thieves and all the other people who we want to secure our communications against. And that's kind of an impossible thing to do. But the fact that he's promised to do it is pretty disturbing.
Last year on Boing Boing, the blog that you write for, you posted about the fact that simply following Boing Boing or clicking on links that had anything to do with privacy or tours, that meant you'd likely be targeted by the NSA for higher level of surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's one of those chilling things that it just seems to promote more self-censorship than anything.
Yeah, so the context for that is that second leaker, that person who may or may not still be at the NSA, who came after Snowden. And he leaked, I believe, to Poitras. I don't know for sure. But Poitras published an article about one of his leaks, which was about the deep packet inspection rules for the fiber taps that the surveillance agencies do, the Five Eyes surveillance agencies, NSA, GCHQ, and the spy agencies from Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And they have these taps in the main fiber links that connect the backbones of the internet. And there are rules associated with the traffic that they see. And one of the rules is if you see someone searching on or reading articles about a privacy technology called Tails, which is a secure operating system you can boot your computer up into if you don't trust it, so that you can send messages with good security. If you see anyone searching on this, then add their identifiers to a list of people for whom all communications will henceforth be captured and retained. So not just your metadata, but everything that you send and receive, and not just retained for 30 days, but retained forever. So you will be a target of surveillance as opposed to untargeted surveillance. And it's hard to know why they're doing this. Obviously, you know, we end up doing what they used to call in the Soviet Union Kremlinology, because our leaders won't explain what they're doing, and they won't explain why they're doing it. So we have to kind of sit around and spitball theories about why, if we were, you know, an evil mustache-stroking genius, we would be doing this. And my theory is, we know from Snowden and from others that they can't break strong cryptography. But if you capture all of the traffic of everyone who is capable of using strong cryptography, then what you get is all the unencrypted messages that flow into them from people who don't know how to use crypto. And then you have a bunch of messages you can't see. And then you have the messages that flow out again. So if you're a journalist and you know how to use strong crypto because you want to make sure that you can protect your sources, maybe you get an unencrypted email from someone that says, there's a friend of mine who really wants to talk to a journalist. Can I send them your way? And you send back a message that's not encrypted that says yes. And then an encrypted message shows up a little while later from someone who has been given your email address, and they can't read that, and it has a nondescript subject line, so they can't tell what it's about, but they can see that then you email your editor, and your editor and you email a third party, and then there's a lot of back and forth, and then an article pops out about a whistleblower. And from that, they can piece together who the whistleblower was and what they told you, even though the stuff that's in the middle is still a black box. And that's my theory, is if you're treating hard drives as free, and you're treating data centers as free, which I think is common in the intelligence services, not least because the more you spend on data services, the more money you throw to defense contractors that you might want to go and get a job with when you finish your term in government services. And if you treat that as free, then, yeah, capturing the full load of all the communications of everybody who can encrypt is worth doing. And that's one of the reasons that we have to teach more people to encrypt, is we have to change those economics. As Smarty McCarthy said, if it costs $10,000 to spy on someone instead of $0 to spy on someone, the spy agencies would choose their targets. They go after people they had a darn good reason to go after, as opposed to just doing these crazy things like, anyone who knows how to keep a secret should have everything that they do surveilled forever.
So it's like Chris Rock's joke about raising the price of bullets instead of having gun control. You know, if you charge $10,000 for a bullet, you're going to think about who you shoot.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't know enough about the manufacturer of ammunition to know whether or not that's practical, although, of course, it's very funny. But I do know enough about crypto to know that if we all used it, that mass surveillance, untargeted mass surveillance, would be largely a dead letter. Although individualized surveillance, the kind of thing where, you know, black bag guys break into your house and hide cameras, or where they find a snitch who'll snitch out on you, or where they swap your laptop at the border during an inspection with another one that has a bug in it, or whatever, that kind of stuff, it's sort of in the $10,000 per person range, that stuff will still work, but the whole business of like, oh, well, here's a new Gmail user, and we've already got Prism in Google's data center, that means that we can spy on that person for free, let's just add them to the list, that kind of thing would end.
That was producer Noel Black speaking with blogger, activist, and author Cory Doctorow. You can listen to the entire interview at our website, krcc.org. The Big Something is produced by Noel Black and me, Jake Brownell, for KRCC, with help from Emily Frogen and Amelia Whitmer. You can listen again to this episode and learn more about today's guest at krcc.org. The Big Something is part of KRCC Presents, a new weekly showcase of locally produced content right here on Radio Colorado College. Tune in for original, local programming every Friday at 7 p.m. and Sunday at 4 p.m. on 91.5 KRCC.